From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Is the surge working? President Bush wants to withhold judgment till the fall, but critics in both parties have seen enough and are pressing the White House for answers now. And at the center of the debate, there are numbers. Always numbers.
U.S. troops continue to die, 29 so far this month, as the sectarian violence their policing continues.
We cannot sustain 160,000 troops indefinitely.
He asked for, you know, 20-something thousand troops, and I said, if that's what you need, Commander, that's what you got. And they just showed up.
That was the president on Tuesday. We're hearing a lot about troop numbers these days, but absent from almost all these discussions are mentions of the role private contractors are playing in the war. In fact, that role is enormous.
Last week, the Los Angeles Times reported that the number of American-funded contractors in Iraq now exceeds the number of U.S. troops there. But that was a rare piece of contractor news. Deborah Avant is a political scientist at the University of California, Irvine, who studied the media profile of military contractors, and she says the dearth of coverage is perfectly represented in the pages of the New York Times.
I found that basically it mentions troops about 10 times as often as it mentions contractors. So even though an occasional article might hit the front pages, there's not this sort of steady flow of information. The press is not capturing changes in the numbers of contractors in the field in Iraq. When the president wanted to mobilize an additional 20,000 troops, it caused a huge political uproar. But in fact, he had managed to mobilize many more than that by sending contractors to the field way early in the insurgency. And that has continued.
How has it come to pass that this could all have taken place so under the radar of the media?
I think that one of the difficulties for news organizations has been that they're sort of set up to cover the Pentagon on the one hand and to cover business on the other. And covering contractors falls a bit between the cracks. Contractors are not as centralized as the Pentagon. They recruit all over the world. And so this is a much more diffuse a set of organizations to cover than the military forces. But it's also true that periodically press attempts to uncover large amounts of information, for instance, about the number of incidents reported in contractors, you know, using firearms or otherwise potentially breaking the law. The LA Times ran into issues where their freedom of information requests were blocked by the contractors, arguing that they would uncover sensitive proprietary information if they were to release that kind of data.
The Pentagon, at the beginning of this Iraq war, famously invited journalists to embed with various units, and this is a program that actually goes on to this day. What about the contractors? Have they been similarly open to journalists and other outsiders coming to see their mission on the ground, or has it been all stonewalling all the time? What's their position?
Well, I haven't done a systematic study of this, but I do know anecdotally that a number of companies have offered to have people come and travel with them. And I know of a few reporters that have taken them up on that offer. As with the embeds in the troops, there's always the possibility that contractors invite reporters to come along on missions where they don't expect problems to occur, et cetera. But I certainly don't have the sense that contractors are stonewalling all the time.
Putting aside for a moment what hasn't been printed and broadcast, you did a study that looked, among other things, at the reaction of audiences to news about private contractors. Can you tell me more about that?
Well, what I did was a simple experiment where I had people read simulated press stories of troops dying versus contractors dying. And I found huge differences in how people thought these different forces were motivated. People generally thought that private contractors were motivated by money and that soldiers were motivated by patriotism. But when it came to their emotional reactions to the stories of either deaths or their support for the war, I didn't find any difference at all. In other words, people were just as outraged or saddened by reading about contractors dying, even foreign contractors dying, as they were reading about soldiers dying. And no matter what article they read, people did not support the war less or more after reading about contractor deaths than troop deaths. And so given the fact that people do react similarly to the deaths of contractors and soldiers, if in fact the number of contractor deaths were added to the number of soldier deaths. And if they were covered to the degree that soldiers' deaths are covered, that could have, you know, significant impact on how the public views the war in Iraq.
I want to ask you one more question, and this may be getting beyond your area of expertise. But as the calls from Congress get louder for the president to scale back our troop levels in Iraq, and as Republicans in the Congress join in those demands, is it possible that the Pentagon will, you know, publicly reduce troop strengths, but then form a kind of shadow army of contractors to replace them with, you know, no net decrease in actual armed forces there?
That's absolutely possible. And in fact, that's something that many contractors expect. And I think this is also complicated by the fact that many of these companies recruit from citizens all over the world. And so it's not that there will be, you know, the same number of American citizens perhaps in the field, but there will be the same number of people that the U.S. dollars are deploying into the field. And so I think it's very important that the press unearth these stories and that the public find out about the degree to which private forces are substituting for public ones.
All right, Deborah. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Deborah Avant is a political science professor at the University of California, Irvine, and the author of The Market for Force, The Consequences of Privatizing Security. Some journalists have tackled the private contracting story despite the reporting constraints. For example, Jeremy Scahill, who had reported from Fallujah, began to wonder about the secretive Blackwater Company when four of their contractors in Iraq were ambushed, burned to death, and hung from a bridge in 2004. The incident launched Scahill on an investigation that lasted long after the story faded from the front pages. His book, Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, details the private force that he says has received U.S. government contracts worth more than $750 million since 2004. Jeremy, welcome to the show.
It's good to be with you, Bob.
How did you go about doing your reporting? Strikes me that this would have been something of a challenge. I'm going to take a wild guess that Blackwater did not invite you in with open arms to see its operations.
Let's just say I wasn't embedded with Blackwater in Iraq. Any journalist who sets out to investigate a company immediately goes and says, oh, I want to look at shareholder reports and start looking at documentation. Well, Blackwater is a privately held company. So already you're up against a wall unless you can convince someone to leak them to you or hand them over to you. And so we had to go through a process of filing a lot of Freedom of Information Act requests, which we did with the U.S. State Department, with the Pentagon, with the Department of the Interior. And we started to get some of those requests fulfilled. And then once you see some contracts and documentation, then it raises more questions. It sends you in different directions. So we were feverishly filing all of these FOIA requests over the course of a year. At the same time, we were reaching out to people who had previously worked in an executive capacity for Blackwater and, in fact, interviewed a number of the people who were involved in the early stages of the company. And they gave us great insight into how the company functions. I talked to former contractors who had worked in Iraq and Afghanistan with Blackwater, as well as the families of contractors. And through all of the great reporting of local reporters in Blackwater's area from the Virginian Pilot and the Raleigh News and Observer, we were able to paint what I think is about 1% of the picture about Blackwater, because it's such a secretive company and it's very much protected by the national security bureaucracy in this country.
Now, we saw in the Pat Tillman friendly fire incident in Afghanistan that a U.S. Army regular can lose his life, and his family back in the States can really only through a series of investigations find out what actually happened. There have been 917 private contractors killed in Iraq, 14,000 of them wounded. Do their families ever find out the circumstances of these casualties?
Well, it depends on the company and how much the company wants to share with them. In the case of the four Blackwater contractors who were ambushed and killed in Fallujah, their bodies strung up from a bridge, the families of those four men say that Blackwater refused to answer their questions and wasn't being transparent with them. And so they actually filed a groundbreaking wrongful death lawsuit against Blackwater in January of 2005. And Blackwater has fought back ferociously against that lawsuit. And in fact, the entire war industry has been paying close attention to that case, because what could happen if it's heard in an open court is that Blackwater would have to hand over documents. Executives of the company would be deposed. It could be an incredibly damning moment for the war industry itself. Now, what's interesting about the statistics that you cite, the 917 contractors that we know have been killed in Iraq, the 14,000 wounded, those are just people whose families have applied for federal death or injury benefits. I believe it only represents a fraction of the contractors killed in Iraq. And the fact is that the majority of contractors in Iraq right now are actually Iraqis working in the service of these other companies for the United States. And so it's a way of masking the human costs of the occupation.
Now, you mentioned that you filed many Freedom of Information requests. And I'm curious how forthcoming the various agencies were in giving you information about what's going on over there, you know, behind the shroud of private contracting.
Well, it depends on the agency that you're applying through. I had one incident that happened where I got a hold of a document through the U.S. State Department and reported on it, and it caused a congressional investigation both in the Senate and the House. And the next time I went to apply for a document from the U.S. State Department, I was told that because I had created such a nut roll, was the phrase, the last time I had done this, and that they're having to deal with all these congressional calls, that they may not have time to deal with journalist FOIA requests. And that, I think, gives you a sense of how unusual it is for someone to actually ask for these kinds of documents. Because when you do, and when the right people in Congress realize it, then they start to go to work on it. And that ultimately should be the role of journalists in a democratic society. But this is a labyrinth system here. And the fact of the matter is, we can't get documents for any of the contracts through the intelligence agencies. But what's even more disturbing is that some of these contracts have four or five layers of subcontracts, and none of the companies are required to come forward and say who their subcontractors are. So it's a really stunning threat, I think, to democratic media and democratic governance.
Okay. Jeremy, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Bob.
Jeremy Scahill is the author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army.
Coming up, Radio Liberty's problem with President Putin and Croatian teenagers sport fascist symbols as fashion statements.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In Croatia, patriotism and national pride are tangled in a history as checkered as the shield on the nation's flag. For years, the country has tried to come to terms with its World War II-era fascist government, the Ustashes, a puppet state of the Nazis. In the more recent past, Croatia's crimes against humanity during the Balkan Wars serve as painful reminders of the ease with which deep-rooted intolerance can resurface. As the country wrestles with this past, the popularity of a rock star named Marko Perković has some people concerned. His fans adorn themselves with Ustasha symbols and nearly swoon when he starts his show with Ustasha salutes. But is this a fascist resurgence or just teenage rebellion from kids who don't understand their own history? Srđan Dvornik is executive director of the Croatian branch of the Helsinki Committee for Human Rights. He describes the scene at Perković's concert last month in Zagreb before 40,000 cheering adolescents.
There were many young people wearing Ustasha symbols. The singer himself starts the concert with a salute, Ustasha salutes. So he's obviously playing on such symbols, and that's really what worries everybody.
I want to know what Croats learn in school about the Ustasha history of World War II and Croatia's culpability in the Holocaust, which was not insubstantial, hundreds of thousands killed. Is this covered?
Hardly. In the textbooks, you only find a few sentences. The prevailing attitude is that the most important thing is to defend your country, and all other things are of secondary importance. So they don't really care whether Ustashas committed war crimes or whether Croatian defendants in early 90s committed war crimes. What matters is that that was for Croatia.
Tell me, please, about the public reaction to the Perkovich concert. There are some very public complaints expressed, notably by Jews, who were disgusted at the fascist symbolism.
In mainstream media, in government statements and so on, I think everybody now would like to forget the whole thing as soon as possible. But on the other hand, the Minister of Education was ready to attend the concert on Saturday, and only thanks to the fact that it was postponed for one day because of bad weather, he did not. But before the concert on Saturday, he made a statement that it's so nice to see so many young people attending such events.
Unlike Serbia, which seems not to quite have come to grips with its culpability in the Balkan Wars, Croatia has done a fairly straightforward job of denazification. And yet the Minister of Education doesn't seem to be disturbed by hundreds or thousands of young people wearing the black Ustasha caps with some pride. There's a strange disconnect there. Can you explain it?
Well, first of all, I can say clearly and publicly, I can be quoted in Croatia, I think that our Minister of Education is a political idiot. The government, the political elite, they know that now it's politically correct to be against that kind of extremism. That's a matter of adjusting to expectations from abroad. They are all nationalistic, but they know that it is no longer something you show in public.
Well, in the 90s, we learned that longstanding suppressed hostility can rise to the surface in the most horrifying ways. Do we have any reason to fear for this generation that's, in a stadium exchanging the Nazi salute with a pop band?
I was born in 1953. As a friend of mine says, we did not have a hate speech. We had hate silence. We had memories that were suppressed, that were not discussed in the public, that were suppressed under the heavy layer of communist ideology. So it all burst out with the coming of democracy. It's a paradox, but that's true. The open nationalism and chauvinism came to the fore with democracy. But now we have had a possibility to confront such intolerance. So it is possible that gradually we will be able to show these young people why this is wrong. Not because it is forbidden, not because they will be arrested and so on, but because it is wrong.
Well, Surgeon, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Surgeon Dvornik is executive director of the Croatian branch of the Helsinki Committee for Human Rights. Another struggle to control the message is underway in Russia's public schools. Two new Kremlin-approved teaching manuals seem to rewrite Russian history rather than explain it, with lessons like, quote, entry into the club of democratic nations involves surrendering part of your national sovereignty to the U.S., the manuals smack of Soviet-era history texts. The Kremlin argues that the textbooks currently in use might be factual, but they're overly negative and just plain depressing. They say these new manuals will teach Russians to be proud of their country's past. Andrew Osborne is the Moscow correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. He says the manuals are striking because of the relentlessly rosy glow they cast on the nation's most recent history.
For the first time, they covered the entire Putin period, and they have indeed provided a point-by-point justification of some of his most controversial policies. So if you like, both of these manuals really do read like a kind of a hymn to the Putin era.
Now, using textbooks to mold the worldviews of children is not unique to Russia. We've seen examples in Palestine and elsewhere in the Arab world of texts that demonize Jews, for example, or even in the States, the attempts in Kansas and Pennsylvania to turn evolution into a debate in school science texts. Is there any way for you to judge whether this is a lesser or a greater sin that's occurring now in Russia?
I think it's hard to compare, but I think maybe the best comparison is with Russia's own history, and that is to say the Soviet period, when there was indeed only one textbook, and pupils were simply not given a chance to consider alternative interpretations of history. So I think the fear is that the current occupants of the Kremlin are looking back to the Soviet period and kind of using that as a template in some way.
But I can say that one thing that is certainly different from the Soviet era of pure propaganda is Soviet school kids had no access to anything else that was not printed in their textbooks. Today's school children can go onto the internet and see that their textbooks are so starkly different from essentially all other versions of history that are available to them at a mouse click.
I think you're right. I mean, already a debate is raging, you know, on blogs and on the internet about this whole subject. So certainly, I think the Kremlin would have very much liked to have done all of this on the quiet and was hoping that nobody would really notice. But that said, I mean, a lot of people live in pretty isolated parts of Russia where, in fact, they don't have access to these same sources. So they would be more likely, if you like, to take this as received wisdom.
Now, what we're discussing here is manuals for teachers. It's not textbooks themselves. And the education minister, Andrei Fursenko, has told Izvestia that Russia will not return to the Soviet practice of mandating a single textbook. Why do you suppose Putin didn't simply have a single textbook, Soviet style, with his view of Russian history?
Well, he really does care about what people think of him in the West. He doesn't want to give people ammunition to say, you're just a kind of throwback to the Soviet era, because he argues that he's not that. Okay, no, he's not a democrat in the Western sense, but he argues that he has brought stability and prosperity and that he's moving slowly in the direction of democracy at a pace which Russia can withstand.
One of the most disturbing aspects is how the Russian people seem, on the whole, to be just taking the whole thing with a shrug, that they're more than willing to exchange absolute freedom for stability. Is there any evidence of a groundswell of negative reaction to this now that the story is leaking out?
There certainly has been negative reaction, and that has been played out across the country's national newspapers. But I would stress that we're talking about fairly rarefied elite circles here who are getting worked up about these kind of issues. For the vast majority of people, this kind of story is really not an issue. And I think, by and large, that really Russians are beginning to feel good about themselves after the 90s, which for many people here was a rather depressing and humiliating decade. And when we have seen opposition demonstrations, they have been very forcefully dispersed or very tightly controlled at the very least. So it's really one-way traffic here right now. It's one point of view, it's one vision of this country and indeed of the world, which is really dominating here.
Andrew, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Andrew Osborne is the Moscow correspondent for the Wall Street Journal.
On Wednesday, Russia's upper house of parliament joined the lower house in expanding the definition of extremism in the law banning extremism. Many critics noted that the new amendments made it impossible to differentiate between actual extremism and ordinary controversy or criticism of the government. For Russia's dwindling independent media, the new legislation is a disaster. But for Radio Liberty, the 56-year-old service funded by the American Congress, it's a kind of opportunity. When the Soviet Union collapsed, Radio Liberty was just another voice in a pro-democracy chorus. Now, with President Vladimir Putin at the helm, it sometimes finds itself singing almost solo.
We've certainly been told by people in Moscow that Putin has a personal antipathy toward Radio Liberty.
Jeffrey Trimble advises the president of Radio Liberty.
Now, let me be clear. We try to be balanced in our programming. We don't not carry the views of the Kremlin, but we balance that by bringing to the microphone those who can't be heard in the official Russian media because their views are very much at odds with those of the Kremlin.
Last year, the Russian government issued 32 warnings to news outlets for, among other things, airing the views of such dissidents as former chess champion Garry Kasparov.
He was interviewed on the Russian service of Radio Liberty. It remains to be seen as to whether the authorities will challenge us through some kind of reprimand or other action under the extremism law. We will, however, not back away from doing that kind of programming. We simply can't and perform our mission.
So what is Radio Liberty's mission? The U.S. government created Radio Free Europe to carry the message of American democracy to the Soviet Union's satellite nations in their own languages. Its sister service, Radio Liberty, now headquartered in Prague, did the same thing for Russia itself. When it began, the message was, admittedly, a little crude.
This is Radio Free Europe. Yes, the programs of Radio Free Europe are diversified. But every word, every piece of music is designed to interest and inform the enslaved peoples behind the Iron Curtain.
Later, of course, the propagandists gave way to local reporters who openly embraced the American notion of the marketplace of ideas. And for a few years, that was no big deal. But now, all the major broadcast outlets are once again controlled by the Kremlin.
Now an audience has come to Radio Liberty that is not traditional. It's much younger. They don't remember Radio Liberty as the voice of the Western enemy.
Anna Kachkayeva is a media analyst with Radio Liberty.
They listen to and read our information because they are genuinely seeking a different point of view. Generally, they don't tune in to us except in times of national crisis.
That is, when they can. In 1991, Boris Yeltsin granted Radio Liberty special status, giving free rein to its journalists and the freedom to broadcast on Russia's regional stations with few strings attached. In 2002, that status was revoked. Though some officials denied it, others hinted that it was a response to Radio Liberty's coverage of the war in Chechnya. More recently, Yuri Bagrov reported for Radio Liberty from Chechnya. He reported on abductions, on the corruption of commanding officers, on closely held casualty figures. He was barred from public events. He was forbidden to travel. He was stripped of his passport. Now stateless, he lives in New York. Meanwhile, the Kremlin tightens its grip on the media, and Putin's popularity holds strong and steady. Did it bother you that the public doesn't seem to care very much about free speech?
Yes, without question, it's heartbreaking. It really bothers me that people don't protest in the streets. I can say that we can't build a democracy on blood. I can say that we can't build a democracy when we murder journalists. I can say it, but the people's minds won't change.
One of the differences that's troubling between now and, say, 20 years ago is that people, according to our data, seem very content with the news they're getting from inside Russia.
Don Jensen is Radio Liberty's Director of Research and Analysis.
And if people say they're content and they say they like the style of the regime, it creates a very, very strong barrier for us compared to 1988, say, when people weren't happy with what they were getting from official Kremlin sources.
Are you there to convert people to democracy?
No.
I'll take a shot at that.
Jeffrey Trimble.
Information is, has been famously said, the oxygen of democracy. We give people information to make up their own minds about the kind of societies in which they want to live.
Russia will elect a new president in March, and the TV coverage of the candidates will be controlled by the Kremlin, just like last time. Meanwhile, Radio Liberty has lost more than half its national audience, due in large part to the strictly enforced requirement that broadcasters thoroughly document whatever they air, especially from foreign news sources. This regulatory hurdle has become ever more onerous since Radio Liberty reporter Andrei Babitsky interviewed a Chechen terrorist in 2005. The number of stations airing Radio Liberty in the provinces dropped precipitously from more than 30 to 4. Even in Moscow and St. Petersburg, it's relegated to hard-to-find frequencies.
Yes, it is difficult to be on the air now.
Elena Glushkova is the Moscow bureau chief of Radio Liberty.
However, this is new era of digital radio, digital television, the era of internet, and more people in Russia have access to internet, which is a very promising thing.
Radio Liberty's internet service has about 600,000 unique visitors a month, a number that's growing fast, and so far the Kremlin doesn't seem to care. But Radio Liberty also faces a challenge from the White House, which proposes cutting the Russia service by 25% while expanding the service to the Middle East. So far, the Middle East services have had little impact there. They're not trusted. They lack the credibility of the durable Moscow service, which has, or had, one of the largest news organizations in Russia, including a couple of hundred native-born freelancers. Yuri Bagrov doesn't for a moment think he was a propagandist, just a reporter who's lost both job and country.
Unfortunately,
just when Russia is in need of real information, Radio Liberty is just barely surviving because of budget cuts. It's the truth, and it's really sad because people want to work and they know how to work, and the work isn't there.
The evidence suggests that in the age of terrorism, hearts and minds campaigns, at least American ones, don't work. But in Russia, many of those hearts and minds are already won. A lot of them belong to young reporters like Yuri Bagrov, who have important stories to tell their fellow Russians, but no longer a place to tell them.
Coming up, a survey of Sunni media in Iraq shows the insurgency has many faces, and the AK-47 turns 60.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org, and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with a few of your letters. About our piece on so-called greenwashing ads, Dan from Washington, D.C. posted a comment asserting that our guest, John Stauber, had oversimplified Coca-Cola's relationship with the World Wildlife Fund. Dan wrote that the partnership, quote, goes way beyond the simple cutting of a $20 million check to WWF by Coca-Cola. It includes a wide array of actions, including a reduction of water usage and local community work in Coca-Cola's places of business. Corporations should be scrutinized for their actions, but not misrepresented in order to prove a point. John Stauber posted his own reply to the comments page, saying that he stood by what he said in the interview.
That same segment nearly caused bodily harm to Craig Stevens of Sacramento, who writes, quote, I was at the gym listening to a podcast of your show when the piece about corporate greenwashing came on. At the same time, I glanced up at the TV screen to see a commercial by the petroleum industry showing an 18-wheeler driving through the Southwest, cleaning the air as it went. I almost fell off the treadmill.
Many listeners appreciated Michael Cavanaugh's story about a peace-promoting radio soap opera in Rwanda. Michelle Williams wrote in from Washington, D.C. to say, quote, thank you for reporting on something positive in the African continent, which in this country gets either no news or bad news.
Post your own comment on our site at www.onthemedia.org or send an email to onthemedia@wnyc.org. And don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
Ago, we asked whether the press was uncritically repeating Pentagon claims that the biggest threat in Iraq right now is Al-Qaeda. Since then, New York Times public editor Clark Hoyt also has addressed the issue, saying that Al-Qaeda in Iraq is hardly the only source of violence and that the Times has been guilty of not enough skepticism. It is true that while it's often too dangerous for Western reporters to check claims about the presence of various Sunni groups on the ground, Reporters don't have to leave their hotel rooms to gauge the insurgent group's presence on the web. Analysts at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, have just released one of the most comprehensive catalogs to date of the insurgency's online output. It paints the picture of a sophisticated distribution network targeting the Arab world's educated elites. And it suggests that the whole notion of a Sunni insurgency itself may be flawed, because the messages being disseminated by these various groups range widely and often contradict each other. Daniel Kimmage co-authored the report. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Can you describe how extensive the insurgent media machine is? I mean, what's the output in a given day?
Well, the output in a given day is 25 to 30 press releases, maybe a couple of videos. If you hit the right day, there'll be a magazine coming out, maybe a full-length film. But I would just stress that, you know, machine sort of implies a single coordinated apparatus, and we're talking here about the collective cumulative efforts of an uncoordinated group. So it varies, but it's fairly impressive. I mean, if you look on a monthly basis, it's almost what a multimedia conglomerate would produce.
And let's talk about the video. A lot of people here probably think of the infamous beheading sequences, either that or a static shot of a masked man reading a statement into a camera. Is that the kind of thing that makes up the majority of insurgent video?
Well, that's the majority of what garners coverage in Western news outlets. Of course, you know, when a Western hostage is involved. But if you go through a month on one of the forums that's the primary distribution channel for these insurgent videos, most of the videos would probably be simply a short clip of an attack on a U.S. military vehicle. What they want to do is provide visual confirmation of what they're claiming to carry out in their statements and press releases. So the primary aim with the short attack videos, at least, is simply to show this is what we're doing.
So let's move then from video to text. There you have the messages broken down into two distinct groups or statements, right?
Yeah, well, of those statements, the bulk are operational. They talk about attacks that they claim to have carried out. But a very significant subset are the political statements, which express various views on topical issues of the day. And they also reflect conflicts and differences between insurgent groups when those arise.
We've been hearing from U.S. officials a lot lately that the violence comes mostly from a group that calls itself Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Is that backed up by the statements? Are the statements an accurate reflection?
Well, this is a complicated issue, because if you look at all the statements, the insurgent groups are clearly claiming more attacks than are being reported by other news sources. So I don't think that it's an accurate reflection of what's happening on the ground. By the same token, if you look at the statements, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which now calls itself the Islamic State of Iraq, certainly releases a large number of statements. They're also very media savvy, and they package their statements in a way that they have a very large presence in the media and on the web. But there are other groups that release almost as many statements. The Islamic Army in Iraq, which is a more nationalist and less jihadist group, they also release quite a large number of statements.
You mentioned two groups that are responsible for a lot of the media. They have two different ultimate goals.
Well, it's quite a striking difference, actually. Al-Qaeda in Iraq, or the Islamic State of Iraq, they see Iraq as the jumping-off point for a larger jihad that has implications throughout the Arab Muslim world. It's part of a global struggle to them. Whereas if you look at the Islamic Army in Iraq, they've said specifically, and their spokesman said in an interview with Al Jazeera, that our goals don't extend beyond the borders of Iraq. So that's a conflict.
Kind of reminds me of the two arguments over communism in its early days. But have we seen any of that conflict play out yet?
There was a flurry of statements, and it was a fascinating moment because these polemics are being carried out in public, where anyone who reads Arabic can look at these statements, can follow the dispute between these two groups. And on the ground, they've clashed because some of these statements leveled very direct accusations. The Islamic Army in Iraq said that fighters from the Islamic State of Iraq, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, had killed some of their people. And so we've certainly seen this both play out in the media and on the ground.
And we should stipulate that this argument is within the Sunni insurgency.
Yes, and one of the purposes of this report is to demystify and unpack the term Sunni insurgency. We wanted to show that there are different groups with slightly different media strategies, that it's not an undifferentiated mass.
Then which among these groups, the globalists or the nationalists, has the loudest voice online? Which one's winning?
You know, this is a fascinating question because this raises the issue of the virtual versus on the ground. Now, the information we have from on the ground indicates that very few Iraqis would support a global jihad in the service of Al-Qaeda's ideological platform. But on the internet, they're extremely effective at spreading their message. So their media presence may sometimes lead us to believe that they are more of a presence on the ground, which is definitely what they would like to suggest, than in fact they are. But what's interesting, I think, about the insurgent media is that up until now, it's really been trading off its strengths. Now, as we see more fissures within the insurgency, it'll be interesting to see how that message survives and how viable it continues to be.
Daniel, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Daniel Kimmage co-authored Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Survey of Sunni Insurgent Media.
Of all the weapons in the vast Soviet arsenal, nothing was more profitable than Avtomat Kalashnikova, model of 1947, more commonly known as the AK-47 or Kalashnikov.
It's the That's actor Nicolas Cage as arms dealer Yuri Orlov in the 2005 movie Lord of War.
It doesn't break, jam, or overheat. It will shoot whether it's covered in mud or filled with sand. It's so easy, even a child can use it, and they do.
In the 60 years since Mikhail Kalashnikov created the AK-47, it has become the most popular assault rifle in the world. As Orlov notes in the film, the Soviets emblazoned it on a coin, the nation of Mozambique on its flag, to celebrate the gun's role in overthrowing Portuguese colonials. Russian President Vladimir Putin himself said at a ceremony a week ago, quote, "The Kalashnikov rifle is a symbol of the creative genius of our people." Michael Hodges is the author of AK-47, The Story of the People's Gun, published last month by Scepter. He says that even the story of the gun's creation was a media invention.
That's right. It first came to the notice of the Russian people in an article in Pravda, where Mikhail Kalashnikov was given as an example of the perfect proletarian, the perfect communist citizen, whose ingenuity had created this weapon that was going to defend the revolution and socialism. So even in 1947, the AK-47 was a creature of the media, I think you could argue.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, how it was actually used, at least in the 50s and 60s, was not to defend one's motherland or fatherland, but to overthrow their leadership. It became the gun of third world revolutionaries.
I think that the key moment in the AK-47's journey from, if you will, the state gun of Soviet communism to the international symbol of a more kind of libertarian idea of revolution, the more 60s countercultural idea of what revolution meant, was Vietnam and certainly the Tet Offensive in 1968, when astonishing footage of Viet Cong soldiers, guys in black pajamas with this incredible distinctive assault rifle with its almost phallic banana magazine curving away underneath it, alerted the world to its imagery and was laden with power. And in the same year as 68, also in the area where the AK-47 would perhaps take on its most sinister imagery eventually, the Israeli army invaded Jordan, a 10,000-strong raiding party to try and crush Fatah, Yasser Arafat's branch of the Palestine Liberation Organization. And although technically they won for the first time, they were held by Palestinian fighters. And Time magazine over there in New York put Arafat for the first time on the cover. And next to him was, as Time put it at the time, a fedayeen, the new Arab guerrilla, holding an AK-47. And that was a key moment, I think, in the AK-47 being perceived throughout the world as the weapon of the underdog.
Before we move back to the Middle East, let's stay in Southeast Asia for the moment. It was noted at the time the American soldiers in Vietnam realized quickly that the AKs they confiscated from dead soldiers worked better than their own M16s.
The M16 was almost over-engineered. I mean, it was, in the sense of its technical superiority, its caliber, its engineering, the best assault rifle in the world. But the jungles of Vietnam didn't require the best assault rifle in the world. They required the toughest. So in the heat and mud of Southeast Asia, the M16 jammed, it rusted, it expanded and didn't shoot, which is kind of important in a battle that your gun shoots. I mean, originally it was American Special Forces, the guys that were dropped behind the lines to look for the Ho Chi Minh Trail, who started taking the enemy gun with them, primarily because they knew they could trust it. But eventually it became quite commonplace for American soldiers in general to pick up AK-47s in the battlefield where they found them.
Tell us how Osama bin Laden first encountered the AK-47.
Well, the story of the AK-47 is rich in irony, but this is perhaps the most ironic episode. I was in Israel in 1982 when the Israelis invaded the Lebanon, primarily to disarm the Palestinian guerrillas there, which they did. And shortly after the invasion, I went to a public park in Israel where on display were thousands and thousands of AK-47s that the Israelis had captured. And in this public park, there was music, there were picnicking families, there was laughter. The imagery of the gun was such that the Palestinian without the AK was a cause for celebration. Those same AK-47s that had been taken were then sent by the CIA and shipped via the Pakistani secret services into Afghanistan, where they were then given to the jihadis who were fighting the Russians there. The first time Osama bin Laden picked up an AK-47, it was quite likely to have been given to him indirectly by the CIA.
And now the gun has become a virtual symbol of international terrorism and jihad, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. And in training camps in the Philippines, there are murals on the walls depicting two hands, one holding an AK-47, the other holding the Quran. And the double K of the Quran and the Kalashnikov has become the dual symbol of the jihad across the world.
It's also become a symbol of urban struggle that's made its way into a lot of popular music, especially rap. In fact, we've created a montage. AK-47, assault rifle, hold the 50, I'm nifty, proud, I got a new style. Seven ways to swing an AK, drop 10 grenades, sing serenades, we in the streets. I didn't even have to use my AK, I gotta say it was a good day.
It has a particular appeal, certainly to black, disadvantaged, angry youth, because it's not only cheap and available, but also it carries with it a revolutionary imagery that no other weapon can give them. Rock and roll here in England has always been slightly in love with guns, probably because most rock and rollers don't see what guns actually do when they're fired. But the Clash here have had machine guns on their T-shirts, and the Manic Street Preachers have sung about AK-47s. It gives a kind of cheap kudos, a revolutionary danger to rock and roll, which I don't take very seriously, but I think in urban music it should be taken very seriously indeed.
It's also made its way into Hollywood films, from Rambo to Quentin Tarantino's Jackie Brown. We have an expurgated clip of that.
AK-47, the very best there is. When you absolutely, positively got to kill every motherfucker in the room, except no substitutes.
Tarantino films are cartoonish, and there's a definite lightheartedness about the way violence is portrayed. But Hollywood has been dealing with the AK-47. Since America withdrew from the Vietnam War, I guess you guys lost the war, but Hollywood decided you could win the weapon that beat you. Like ink on blotting paper spreading throughout American culture. I think Hollywood acted as an effective propaganda tool, an advertising agency for a weapon which they, in retrospect, might regret doing, I think.
Kalashnikov is now 87 years old. He seems to be of two minds about this gun he brought into the world. He told you that sometimes he wishes he'd invented a lawnmower. On the other hand, he said recently that his conscience is clear. You visited with him at his dacha in Russia. What's your impression?
As he sits there in his old age watching the news and sees things like Beslan, the slaughter of the school children there, which was an AK-47 battle primarily, when he sees Osama bin Laden with an AK-47 by his side. Eventually, these things force him into a position where he feels obliged to defend himself. So though he doesn't feel he's to be blamed, he feels obliged to speak out. When I first met the general, and we were sipping vodka, as you do in Russia, He described the AK-47 to me as the golem, which is the mythical creature of Eastern European Yiddish culture. When you take inanimate material, in that case clay, and you invest it with life, and it goes off and does your bidding, but of course in the legend it gets a mind of its own and you can't get it back. And I thought it interesting that the general should call the AK-47 the golem, because that's what it's done. It's long, long, long ago slipped out of his control.
Michael, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure, Brooke. Thank you.
Michael Hodges is the author of AK-47, The Story of the People's Gun, published by Scepter.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer, assisted by Rob Christensen. We had help from Madeline Elish, Andrea Ambrose, and Cara McCormick. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org, and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.